Physics. September 29, 1961, lecture number 2, The Present Situation in Basic Physics. September 29, 1961, lecture number 2, The Present Situation in Basic Physics. September 29, 1961, lecture number 2, The Present Situation in Basic Physics.
This is the second of three lectures whose purpose it is to acquaint you with the position of physics or science in general, what our view of the world is. And in this lecture, I'm going to tell all of the ideas, the fundamental ideas that we have in physics. You'll find the summary of the previous lecture on this board always. I want to discuss the nature of things as we see it at present time. We're not going to discuss the history of it or how we know that all this is true, but only what we found out to be true. You'll learn all the details in due time, but in the meantime, we have a very rough, very rapid sketch through everything. So the name of this lecture, the second lecture, is The Present Situation in Basic Physics. Now, the things that we concern ourselves with in science appear in a myriad of forms and in a multitude of attributes. For instance, if you stand at the seashore and look out, then you see, of course, the water, the waves breaking, the foam, the sloshing motion of the water, the sounds, the air and the winds and the clouds, and the sun and the blue sky and light. And there's sand and there's rocks of various hardness, permanence, color, and texture. There's animals in the sea and seaweed. There's hunger and disease. There's the observer standing on the beach. Maybe there's even happiness and thought. Any other spot in nature has a similar variety of things and influences. It's always as complicated as that, no matter where you look. Curiosity demands that we ask questions, that we try to put the things together to understand this multitude of aspects as perhaps the action of a small number of elemental things, or things and forces, perhaps, in an infinite variety of combinations. For instance, is the sand other than the rocks? That is to say, is the sand maybe nothing but a great number of very tiny stones? Is the moon a rock? What we mean is, if we understood rocks, would we also understand the sand and the moon? And so, another example, is the wind a sloshing of the air analogous to the sloshing motion of the water in the sea? What common features do different movements have? What's common to different kinds of sound? How many different colors are there, and so on? And so we gradually try to analyze all this, trying to put together things which at first sight look different, with the hope that we may be able to reduce the thing and understand it better. A few hundred years ago, a method was devised to find partial answers to such questions, and I wish to give you a report on the progress to date in analyzing these things. By observation, reason, and experiment, of course, is the method that we call the science. Now, what I'm limiting myself to is a description of our basic view or basic ideas of what they sometimes call the fundamental physics or fundamental ideas. And I'd like to explain what that means and also what the difference, what we mean by understanding something a little bit. In this complicated array of moving things, you can imagine it's something like trying to watch a great chess game being played by the gods, you see, and you don't know what the rules of the game are, but all you're allowed to do is watch the playing. Now, of course, if you watch long enough, you may eventually catch on to a few of the rules. The rules of the game is what I mean by the fundamental physics. Even if you knew every rule, however, you may not be able to keep up to understand why a particular move is made in the game merely because it's too complicated and your mind is limited. You must know, if you know how to play chess, that it's easy to learn all the rules, and yet it's very hard to select the best move or to understand why Alekhine did that. And so in the same manner, only much worse is it in nature, that we may be able to find all the rules. Actually, we do not have all the rules. We know that we don't have all the rules. Every once in a while, something like castling or something is going on that we still don't understand. But aside from not knowing all the rules, what we really can explain in terms of those rules is very, very limited. Because in almost all situations, like the man standing at the seashore, the situation is so enormously complicated that we cannot follow how everybody's doing all the rules and what's going to happen next. But I must, so I'm limiting myself, therefore, to this more basic, the rules, the question of the rules of the game, which I'm going to try to describe here. Now, how can we tell if the rules are all right if we can't analyze the game very well? How do we know we guessed the right rules if we can't analyze the game? There are approximately, roughly speaking, three ways. First, there may be simple situations. In one corner of the board, there's only a few pieces at work, and that we can figure out exactly. And so we have situations where this nature is arranged, or we arrange nature purposely to be so simple and have so few parts working there that we can figure out exactly what would happen, and we can check whether our rules work there. Another interesting way to check rules is in terms of overall theorems. For example, if the rule of the movement on the bishop on the chessboard is that it moves only on the diagonal, then one can deduce that no matter how many moves have been made and no matter what happens, a bishop that's on a red square will always be on a red square. So without being able to follow the details, you can always check your idea about the bishop motion by finding out if it always is on a red square. And of course you will for a long time until all of a sudden you discover it changed to a black square. What happened, of course, was in the meantime it got captured, another pawn came down for queening and turned into a bishop on a black square. But that's the way it is with the physics. For a long time we'll have a rule which works excellently in an overall way that we can't, even when we can't follow the details, and then sometime we may discover a violation of the rule in some small way and that discover a new rule. Incidentally, from the point of view of basic physics, the most interesting phenomena are, of course, the new places, the places that don't work, not the places that do work, because there's where we'll discover new rules. Incidentally, the third way to tell if the ideas are right is a crude way, but probably the most powerful of them all, and that is by rough approximation. By that I mean you can may not be able to tell exactly why Alekhine moves this particular piece, but you can roughly understand that he's gathering his pieces around the king to protect it, more or less. That's a sensible thing to do under the circumstances. So in the same way, we can understand nature more or less very often without being able to see what every little piece is doing in terms of our understanding of the game. Well, at first, the phenomena of nature were rapidly divided into classes, classes like heat, electricity, mechanics, magnetism, properties of substances, chemical phenomena, light or optics, X-rays, nuclear physics, gravitation, meson phenomena, and so on. But the aim, of course, is to see nature, complete nature, as different aspects of one set of phenomena. And that's the problem of basic theoretical physics today, to find the laws behind experiment, to see if we can amalgamate these groups. Well, we historically have always been able to amalgamate the groups, but as time goes on, new things are found. We're amalgamating very well when all of a sudden X-rays are found, and then we amalgamate some more, and now mesons are found. So at any one stage of the game, it always looks pretty messed up. A great deal is amalgamated, but then there's all kinds of wires and threads hanging out in all directions, and that's the situation today, which I have to describe. For example, historically, examples of amalgamation are the amalgamation of heat and mechanics. As we the atoms in motion, when the more the motion is, the more the heat that the system contains. And so heat and temperature effects can all be represented by the laws of mechanics. Another tremendous amalgamation was the relationships between electricity, magnetism, and light, which are found to be all different aspects of exactly the same thing, which we call today the electromagnetic field. Still another amalgamation is the unification of chemical phenomena, the properties of various substances, and the behavior of atomic particles, which is in the quantum mechanics of chemistry. The question is, of course, is this always going to be possible? Is it always going to be possible to amalgamate everything and ultimately discover that this entire variety of the world is merely different aspects of one thing? Nobody knows. All we know is that as we go along, we find we can amalgamate pieces and then find pieces that don't fit and keep trying to put the jigsaw puzzle together. But whether there's a finite number of pieces and whether there's a border to this jigsaw puzzle or not is, of course, not known. And it will never be known until we find, if we do ever finish the picture. Now, what I want to do is to tell you today is to what extent this amalgamation process has gone on and what the situation is today in understanding basic phenomena in terms of the smallest set of principles. To put it another way, in simple manner, what are things made of and how few elements are there? It's a little difficult to explain the whole thing right off with the present view, so if you'll excuse me, I will first give a description of how things looked approximately in 1920. But then I have a few things to take out of that picture and correct. So if you'll excuse me, I first do it a little bit historically and set the situation up approximately in 1920, and then we'll fix it. Before 1920 even, the picture was something like this, that the stage on which everything went was the three-dimensional space of geometry, which is described by Euclid. And that things changed in a medium of time, that there was a thing called time which permitted everything to change. So that we have this stage of space and time. And the elements on this stage were particles, the atoms, for example, which had some properties. First, the property of inertia, which is that if they started moving, they keep on going in the same direction unless forces acted. And the second then is forces. So that these particles had inertia and forces. And the forces were of two varieties. First, there was an enormously complicated, detailed kind of interaction forces which held the various atoms in different combinations in a complicated way and which determined whether salt would dissolve faster when you heated the temperature up or slower. These were the interactions between the atoms, and they were not understood at all, and they were very complicated. An additional force that was known was a long-range interaction of a smooth and quiet attraction that varied inversely as the square of the distance, and which was called gravitation. It's called gravitation, and this law was known and very simple. Incidentally, why things remain in motion when they're moving, or why there's a law of gravitation, things like that, of course, were not known. Just a description of nature is what we're involved with here, and we haven't described, connected the things together. From this point of view, a gas was a myriad of moving particles, so that of the things that I described standing at the seashore before, there are several quick things. First, the pressure is a collision of the atoms with the walls or the whatever's in there. The drift of the atoms, if they're all moving more in one direction than on the average, then that's wind. The random motions, the internal motions, is the temperature or the heat. There are waves of excess density. If you have collected too many particles here, then they rush off from here and they push up piles of particles further out, and they push up particles, piles of particles further out, and so on. And this wave of excess density is sound, and so forth. So it was a tremendous achievement to understand so much. I described that in the last lecture. Well, what particles are there? There were 92 at the time. There were 92 different kinds of atoms ultimately discovered with different names associated with the chemical elements. And the next problem was, what were the short-range forces? Incidentally, I must say that in the meantime, other things were discovered. First, the stars and their properties. What are they? Second, electrical phenomena, light the magnetism and light. It was discovered, incidentally, and I haven't time to tell how, that the stars were made of the same atoms as the stuff on the Earth, which made it easier to understand stars than it would have been otherwise. Now the main problem then was the question of what determined the interaction forces between these atoms. Why does carbon attract one oxygen, or perhaps two oxygens, but not three oxygens, and so on? What is the machinery of the interaction between the atoms? Is it gravitation? Do they stick together because everything sticks together by gravitation? The answer is no, the gravity is entirely too weak. But imagine a force analogous to gravity, varying inversely as the square of the distance, enormously more powerful, but having one difference. Gravity, everything attracts everything else. But now imagine that there are two kinds of things, and that this new force, which is electrical force, of course, that I'm describing, has this property that likes repel, but unlikes attract. Then what will happen? With a tremendous force. Well, suppose that we have two unlikes that attract each other, a plus and a minus, and they stick very close together here. Now suppose we have another charge out here from a distance. Will it feel any attraction? Practically nothing. Because if the two are equal in their size, the attraction for the one and for the other balance out. So that there's very little force at a reasonable distance. On the other hand, if we get very close with this extra one, it's nearer to one than to the other of this little object, and then there becomes an attraction. And so you see, this is the reason why the atoms, which are electrically constituted of opposite plus and minus combinations, feel relatively little force when they're any reasonable distance, aside from the gravity, I mean. But when they come close together, they can sort of see inside each other that the thing isn't exactly neutral, and thus have a very strong interaction, so that the ultimate basis of the interaction between the atoms is electrical interaction. If we rub a few of the electrons, if we unbalance the... You see, of course, in normal nature, since this force is so enormous, all the pluses and all the minuses will come together in as intimate a combination as they can. That's you and I, that's stuff. Neutral, made of fine grain, enormously strongly interacting plus and minus parts, all balanced out. Once in a while, by accident, we may rub off a few extra minuses or a few extra pluses. Usually it's easier to rub off a few extra minuses. And under those circumstances, we find the force of electricity unbalanced, and so we find electrical attractions that we discover on a large scale by rubbing your comb through your hair. To give you an idea of how much stronger electricity is than gravitation, I consider two grains of sand, say a millimeter in across, at each end of this room, 100 feet apart. And if the force between them, if the thing weren't balanced, if in other words, like everything attracted everything else instead of likes repelling, so that you didn't have the cancellation, how much force would there be? There would be a force of 3 million tons between those two. So you see that it takes very little excess or deficit of the number of positive or negative charges to produce appreciable electrical effects. That's incidentally why you can't see the difference between a charged, electrically charged thing and an electrically uncharged thing, because so few particles are involved that it hardly makes any difference. Now the atoms were easier to understand. They had a nucleus at the center, which was electrically charged, and I might go a little ahead of my story to discover that in the nucleus there were two particles, protons and neutrons. They're almost the same weight, these two, almost the same mass, very heavy. The protons are electrically charged, the neutrons are neutral. Now, if you have a nucleus with, say, 6 protons inside, I don't care how many neutrons, say 6 if you want, then the negative particles in the world of ordinary world of matter are all electrons. And these are very light, and they sit around the outside, around this thing. Now, how many electrons are going to sit when it's neutral? 6. So that the atom has 6 electrons, and atom number 6 is called carbon. Atom number 8 is oxygen, and so on, because the chemical properties depend upon the electrons on the outside, and that just depends upon how many electrons there are. So the chemical properties of substances depends only on a number, which is the number of electrons. And the whole list of elements of the chemists really should have been called 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Instead of saying carbon, they should have said element 6, meaning 6 electrons. But of course, when they were first discovered, they didn't know that they could be numbered that way. And secondly, it would make everything look pretty complicated. It's good to have names for some of these things instead of calling everything by numbers. Instead of carbon dioxide would be 682 or something. 6 with 2 8s. It would be very confusing. Now, a little more was discovered about the electrical force. The natural interpretation of this electrical thing is that simply the two objects attract each other, plus against minus. But this was discovered to be an inadequate idea to represent it. More adequate to represent the situation was to say that the existence of the positive charge in some sense distorts the space or creates a condition in the space so that when we put the negative charge in, it feels a force. This potentiality for this disturbance of the space is called electric field. And when we put an electron where there's an electric field, we say it's pulled. So we have two rules. Charges make field, and charges in field are moved, have forces on them, instead of saying a direct interaction. The reason for this will become clear when we discuss the following phenomenon. If I were to take charge up a cone, say, with my little electrically, and then have a piece of paper at a distance and move the cone back and forth, of course, the paper will respond by pointing always to the cone. If I shake it faster, it soon is discovered that the paper is a little bit behind, that the law is much more complicated than the direct force. There's a delay in its action. Incidentally, at the first stage, and when you start to move just a little bit slowly, you find a complication, which is magnetism. Magnetic influences have to do with electricity in motion. So magnetism and electricity are really combined into one field. It's two different aspects of exactly the same thing. A changing electric field can't exist without magnetism. And further, when we go faster, we find that there's a delay. And if we move the charge further and further out, the delay is more and more. And then an interesting thing happens. Although the force between these two things should be go as inversely as the square of the distance, it is found when you're shaking it that the oscillating part extends very much further out than you would guess at first sight. What this is analogous to is something like this. If I have to pull something with a string and pull it to one side, well, it's a little hard to, that analogy is not very good. If I'm in, say, a tub of water, or a big pool of water, and there's something very close to me, then I can move that by pushing the water directly. And if you looked at the two objects, all you would see would be that I'm essentially pushing the object. There's some kind of interaction between the object. Of course, what I do is I disturb the water disturbs the object. And you would get a law that if you push a little bit, an object would move, but if it were further out, it would hardly move, because, of course, if I move the water here, it would only do it locally. On the other hand, if I jiggle, a new phenomenon is set up in which the motion of the water here moves the water there and so on, and waves travel away so that if I'm jiggling, there's an influence very much further out that's oscillatory that you can't understand from the direct interaction. And therefore, the idea of a direct interaction has to be replaced with the existence of the water, or what we call the electromagnetic field. And the waves in the electromagnetic field can carry waves, and these waves are light, for example. They're used in practice and radio broadcast, for another example. In fact, let me describe these things. These oscillatory waves can have various frequencies. It's the only thing that's different from one wave to another is the speed of oscillation. If I take that same comb and shake faster and faster and faster and faster and look at the effects, I get a whole series of different kinds of things which are all unified in one thing with only one number. The number here is the number of oscillations per second. The usual pickups that you get from the walls, from the electric currents in the walls and the usual circuits around here and so on, 60 cycles, let's say about 100 cycles. Those are ordinary electrical disturbances. But if you increase the frequency to this range, 500,000 or 500 kilocycles to 1,000 kilocycles is the frequency of oscillations of radio of electromagnetic waves, which you use for radio broadcasts. You're on the air, they say. Of course, it's got nothing to do with the air. You can have radio broadcasts without any air. If you increase the frequency, you get in the range that's used for FM and TV. Go still further, and we use those waves, for instance, in practice, for radar. Still higher, we begin to not need any instrument to see the stuff. We can see it with the human eye. And then the variation of frequency from 5 times 10 to the 4th to 10 to the 15th, we see this, these waves, and we would see them. Our eye would respond to this oscillation of the comb, if I could shake it so fast, as red light or blue light, or violet light, depending on the frequency. Going still below this frequency, we call it infrared. On the other side, we call it ultraviolet. The fact that we can see in that range makes that stuff no more impressive than any other part of the electromagnetic spectrum from a physicist's standpoint. But of course, from a human standpoint, it's very much more interesting. If we go up in higher frequency, we get to X-rays. The X-rays are nothing but high frequency, very high frequency light. Still higher, we get gamma rays. Actually, it's hard to distinguish these. It depends upon where they come from. It's not a good definition. Usually, gamma rays are light that comes, electromagnetic waves that come from nuclei, while X-rays come from atoms at high energy, but it's not very sharply defined. I mean, these are just names. You see, human beings trying to associate some names with numbers again. If we go to still higher frequencies, we find we make those waves artificially with the modern synchrotron, like the synchrotron here at Caltech, can get electromagnetic waves with that frequency. There are even electromagnetic waves at 1,000 times more rapid oscillation in the waves found in cosmic rays, which is something that we can't control. And I described already the idea of the electromagnetic field, that this field can have waves. But then it was soon learned that these waves behave in a strange way. They behave, when you get to the very highest frequencies, much more like a particle. Now, they're, of course, all the same. It's the quantum mechanics which is involved, which was the next discovery after 1920, which had to change all our views. The big discovery, in addition to the classical ideas, which has to be now made, is the quantum mechanics. The picture of space and time, I should go back and say this earlier. At the same time, about that time, the picture of space as a three-dimensional space and the time as separate was changed by Einstein first into a combination space-time, and then still further into a curved space-time, which was to represent the gravitation. So the stage is changed into space-time, and gravitation is presumably a modification of space-time. But the rules of the motions of particles turned out to be incorrect. The mechanical rules of inertia and forces, that's wrong. Newton's laws are wrong. Instead, it was discovered that things on a small scale behave like nothing on a large scale at all. That's what makes physics hard and very interesting. Because it's so unnatural the way things behave on a small scale, because we have no direct experience, because our experience is with things on a large scale. It behaves like nothing at all on a large scale. You say, the trouble with the teachers of physics is they don't explain quantum mechanics like this, that the particles behave like waves, or they behave like billiard balls, or they behave like I don't know what. But they don't behave like anything that you know of, you see. So it's impossible to describe the things except in analytic ways, and with a certain difficulty and taking a lot of imagination. Incidentally, the quantum mechanics has several aspects. In the first place, the idea that a particle has a definite location and a definite speed is no longer allowed. That's wrong. And to give a measure of how wrong classical physics is, there's a rule that says that you can't both know where something is and how fast it's moving. The uncertainty in the momentum of it and the uncertainty in the position are complementary. If your product of the two is a constant. If you want the law, you like to write equations, you can write this. But I will explain it some other time in more detail. This is the explanation of a very mysterious paradox. If the atoms are made out of plus and minus charges, why don't the minus charges simply sit on top of the plus charges? They attract each other. Why don't they just sit there on top? Why is our atom so big? Why, if there is a nucleus here and the electrons around? We first was thought that was because the nucleus was big. No. The nucleus is very small. The atom in its diameter here is 10 to the minus 8 centimeters. The nucleus in its diameter is of the order 10 to the minus 13 centimeters. What does that mean? That means that if you had an atom and you wanted to see the nucleus, you'd have to expand it, magnify it, till the whole atom is the size of this room, and then the nucleus is a bare speck that you can just about make out with the eye, a hundredth of an inch across. And all the weight of the atom is in that infinitesimal nucleus. But what keeps the electrons from simply falling in? This principle. If they sat there, then you'd know where they were and that they weren't moving. And you can't have that. So they don't sit there, because if you try to put them there, they start moving around. Well, they move around and they take a compromise. They leave themselves a little room for this uncertainty, and they jiggle at a certain amount of minimum motion given by this rule. You remember also that when a crystal is cooled to absolute zero, the atoms do not stop moving, they still jiggle. Why? Because if they stopped moving, you'd know where they were and that they had zero motion, and that's against the uncertainty principle. You're not supposed to know where they are and how fast they're moving, so they continually wiggle in there. Now, the most interesting consequence of quantum mechanics, however, not a consequence so much as a change of the philosophy and the ideas of science, of physics, or not the ideas of science, but the ideas that people had in physics, is this. It is not possible to predict exactly what will happen in any circumstance. It is possible to arrange, for example, let's say an atom which is ready to emit light, and you measure when it's emitted light by picking up a photon, a particle, which I'll describe in a minute. You cannot predict when it's going to emit the light, or if you had several atoms, which one is going to. You say, oh, that's because there's some internal wheels that you haven't looked at close enough. No, there's no internal wheels. Nature is of the, as we understand it today, is of this kind, that it's fundamentally impossible to make a precise prediction of exactly what is going to happen in a given experiment. This is a horrible thing. In fact, the philosophers have said before that one of the fundamental assumptions of science is that whenever you set up the same conditions, the same thing happens. Not true. It is not a fundamental condition of science. The fact is that the same thing doesn't happen, that we can get an average statistically as to what happens. But nevertheless, science has not completely collapsed. Philosophers say a great deal, incidentally, about what is absolutely necessary for science, and it's always, as far as I can see, rather naive and probably wrong. One of the things, for instance, that I've read that some philosopher or other said is it's fundamental to the scientific method that the same experiment, if you do a certain experiment in, say, Stockholm, and then you do the same experiment in Quito, the same results will occur. Quite false. It's not necessary for science for that. It may be a fact of experience, but it's not necessary. For instance, if one of the experiments is to look out at the sky and you see the aurora borealis in Stockholm, you don't see it in Quito. So that's a different phenomenon. You say, oh, but that's something that has to do with outside. Can you close yourself up in a box in Stockholm and pull down the shades and then get any difference? There's an interesting phenomenon. If you take a pendulum on a support that can wobble either way, not just go in a plane, but a free support, universal joint up there, and pull it out and let go, then the pendulum swings almost in a plane, but doesn't quite swing in a plane. It slowly, the plane keeps changing in Stockholm, not in Quito. The blinds are pulled down, too. The fact that this happens is not the destruction of science. I tell you what I believe that the fundamental hypothesis of science is, the fundamental philosophy. I wrote it as a summary in the first lecture, that the sole test of the validity of any idea is experiment. And if it turns out from experiment that most experiments work the same in Quito as they do in Stockholm, then those most experiments we will use to formulate some general laws. And those experiments which don't come out the same, we'll say, is the result of the environment near Stockholm or something. We'll invent some way to summarize the results of experiment. We don't have to be told ahead of time what it's going to look like. And if one of the things is, if they tell us that the certain situation must always produce the same result, that's all very well, but if when we try it, it doesn't occur, then it doesn't occur, and we just have to take what we see. So the fundamental philosophy is not any other thing than what we get from looking by experiment, and then we formulate all the rest of our ideas in terms of our experience, in terms of the subject on which we work. Anyhow, this quantum mechanics is difficult to understand, and it is not, usually your students don't learn it until the beginning, perhaps, of the third year. So for 2 years, they only worry about the things which I've mentioned up till now. But in this picture, I must describe everything, so I'll describe the, I can't tell you the details of the quantum mechanical principles, of course, that's too difficult. But I will just say, assume that they are there, just in a historical way, what some of the consequences are. And one of the consequences are that things which used to be waves also behave as particles, and particles behave as waves. In fact, everything behaves the same way. There's no distinction between a wave phenomenon and a particle phenomenon. And so the quantum mechanics unifies the idea of the field of waves and of particles all in one. Now, it's true that when the frequency is low, the field aspect of the phenomena are more accurate or more usually needed to describe it as an approximation for our usual experiences. As the frequency increases, we get the wave picture, but the more the frequency increases, the more the particle aspects of the phenomena stick out with the usual equipment that we use to make the measurements. And so, in fact, although I mentioned here all these frequencies have a phenomenon involving the frequency has yet been detected above approximately here. We only deduce the frequency in these from the energy of the particles by a rule, which assumes that the particle wave in quantum mechanical rules is still okay, so that this is an implied frequency, not a directly measured one. Now, then we have a new view of electromagnetic interactions. We have a new kind of a particle. First, by the way, we had some particles. One was the electron, another was the proton and the neutron, and now we have the electromagnetic field. But in the view of the quantum mechanics, we can describe the whole thing by one new particle, and that particle is called a photon. So we have another particle, a photon. You see? Now, the law which connects, or the interaction of electrons and photons, which is electromagnetic theory, with the quantum mechanical, everything quantum mechanically correct and so on, is called quantum electrodynamics. It's a horrible name, but what it is the fundamental theory of the interactions of light and matter, or electric field and charges. It is our greatest success in physics. In one theory, we have the basic rules for all ordinary phenomena, except for gravitation, which is an ordinary phenomenon. For example, a mechanical phenomena, Newton's laws come out of quantum electrodynamics, electrical laws come out, chemical laws come out, and so on. For instance, the laws of the collision of billiard balls, the motions of wires and magnetic field, the specific heat of carbon monoxide, the color of neon signs, the density of salt, the reactions of hydrogen and oxygen to make water, in fact, any chemical reactions, the color of copper, and so on, are all consequences of this one law, set of laws called quantum electrodynamics. All these details can be worked out if the situation is simple enough for us to make the calculation, which is almost never. But most of the time, we can still figure out more or less what's happening. It depends on the circumstance, how complicated it is. Let's put it this way. At the present time, no exceptions are found to the quantum electrodynamic laws, as long as you stay out of the nucleus and so on. And there, we don't know whether it's an exception to the quantum electrodynamic laws or that we simply don't know what's going on in the nucleus. In principle, then, the quantum electrodynamics is a theory of all chemistry. And if life is ultimately reduced to chemistry and physics, and therefore just to physics, because chemistry is already reduced, the part of physics which is involved is already known. That is, all the laws that are necessary are known. Furthermore, the same quantum electrodynamics, this great thing, predicts a lot of things. In the first place, it tells the properties of very high energy photons, gamma rays, and so on. It comes out right. predicted a very remarkable thing also, that beside the electron, there should be another particle of the same mass but of opposite charge called positron, and that these two coming together could annihilate each other with the emission of light or gamma rays. I mean, after all, light, gamma rays, all the same, it's just on a scale. The existence of, for each particle, that there's an anti, the generalization of this, that for each particle there's an antiparticle, turns out to be true. In the case of electrons, the antiparticle has another name. It's called a positron. But for most other particles, they're simply called anti-so-and-so, like anti-proton or anti-neutron and so on. In this quantum electrodynamics theory, two numbers are put in, and all the rest of the numbers in the world are supposed to come out. The two numbers that are put in, I mean, not the world, it's limited, by the way. The two numbers that are put in are called the mass of the electron and the charge of the electron. Actually, that's not quite true. We have the whole series of extra numbers for chemistry, which tells how heavy all the nuclei are, and that leads us to the next problem. What are the nuclei made out of, and how are they held together? It's found that the nuclei are held together by enormous forces. When those are released, the energy releases are enormous compared to chemical energy, in the same ratio as the atomic bomb explosion is to a TNT explosion. Because, of course, one of them, the atomic bomb, has to do with changes inside the nucleus, while the explosion of TNT has to do with the changes of the electrons and the outsiders of the atom. The question is, what are the forces which hold the protons and neutrons together in the nucleus? Just like electrical interaction was due to a, you know, can be represented in a way as the exchange of photons or electric field, well, there's an electric field between the two, and that these are connected to a particle, the photon, in quantum mechanics. So Yukawa suggested that the forces between neutrons and protons have also got a field of some kind, and that when this field jiggles, it behaves like a particle, and that there should be some other particles in the world besides proton and neutron, and was able to deduce the properties of these particles from the characteristics already known of nuclear forces. First, that they should have a mass of 200 or 300 times an electron and so on. And lo and behold, in cosmic rays, they discovered a particle of the right mass, but I won't chase around this. It was the wrong particle. It was called a mu meson, a muon. It's not the right particle. But a little bit later, in 1947 or 8, another particle was found, the pi meson, which satisfies Yukawa's criteria. So that beside the proton and the neutron, in order to get nuclear forces, we also have to add pi on. Now you say, oh, great. Now we just make the quantum electrodynamics with this theory. We make the quantum nucleodynamics using the pions and so on, just like Yukawa wanted to do, and see if it works, and everything will be explained. Bad luck. It turns out that the calculations that are involved in this theory, because of some differences in the numbers involved, are so great that no one has ever been able to figure out what the consequences are of this theory in order to check it against experiment. And this has been going on now for almost 20 years. And so we're stuck with a theory that we don't know whether it's right or wrong, but we know it's sort of wrong, or at least incomplete, because while we're dawdling around theoretically trying to calculate the consequences of this theory that we can't calculate because it's too hard to calculate, the experimenters are discovering some things, you see, unfortunately. For instance, I already discovered this mu meson or muon, and we don't know where it fits, so we don't want the extra particle, you see. In the meantime, also in cosmic rays, a large number of other extra particles were found. And so it turns out that today we have approximately 30-some-odd particles. And I've only written a few, you see, here. But there's some 30-some-odd particles, and it's very difficult to understand what the relation of all these particles are and what nature wants them for, or what the connections are from one to the other. We do not today understand these various particles as different aspects of the same thing, and the fact that we have so many unconnected particles is a representation of the fact that we have so much unconnected information, that we have not a good theory. So that after the great successes of the quantum electrodynamics, the rough successes, there is a certain amount of knowledge of nuclear physics that's sort of a rough knowledge, from a sort of half experience and half theory, assuming some kind of a force between protons and neutrons and seeing what will happen. but not really understanding where the force comes from. But aside from that, we've made very little progress, and we've collected an enormous number of particles. But like the chemists who collected an enormous number of chemical elements, there suddenly appeared to be relations among these elements which were unexpected, like sodium and potassium are about the same in their chemical properties, and the Mendeleev chart. So we have a Mendeleev-type chart for the new particles. The Mendeleev chart of the new particles was made by Gell-Mann and Nishijima in Japan independently. And here are the particles. All I can do is just list them for you. It's no use telling you much more about them at this stage, but just to show you how much we don't know. So I'll show you the particles. Here is a neutron and proton. Underneath, you'll find the mass of these particles in a certain unit. This unit is called an MeV and is equal to 1.782 times 10 to the minus 27 grams. Why we chose this unit is historical, and I won't involve us in it now. But that's the unit in which all these masses, in other words, you multiply this by that, you'll get the mass of the proton in grams if you need it in grams. But if you can always use that unit if you want. Now, here's the neutron and the proton. They're almost the same mass, very, very close. In this chart, the layout of the chart is this way. In vertical columns, you put the things with the same electrical charge, all neutral objects in this column, all positively charged objects in this column, and all negatively charged objects in this column. Now, particles which go in this chart together with the neutron and proton, they're all called baryons, and the following particles exist. There's a lambda, whose mass is 1154. There are three others, sigmas, minus, neutral, and plus, with several masses, almost exactly the same. You see this chart, the mass sort of, as the particles that are heavier are written higher up, but you see that there are groups or multiplets with almost exactly the same mass. If you forget 1% or 2%, then exactly the same mass. So here's the first multiple is 2, and then there's a single multiplet with 1, and then here's a multiplet with 3, and above is a multiplet with 2. With nearly the same mass. This mass is not measured accurately here. I only think two or three of these have ever been seen. Now, very, very recent, within the last 6 months, a few extra particles have been found. Or are they particles? They live so short a time, they disintegrate almost instantaneously as soon as they're formed. If they disintegrate instantaneously as soon as they're formed, we wouldn't have to worry about them. But they disintegrate almost instantaneously, and so we almost have to worry about them. And we don't know whether or not they should be considered as new particles, in which case they would be called Y1, or some kind of a resonance of interaction at a certain energy between the products that it disintegrates into, which is a lambda and a pi. Since I didn't mention what a pion's, the properties of the pions yet, but there are three kinds, and so there are three of these Ys. So there's another multiple up here. So that's one part of the chart. Now, the other particles which are involved in nuclear interactions are first the pions, as Yukawa wanted, and they come in three varieties, positive, negative, and neutral. And there's another multiplet. Now, it found some new things called K-mesons, and they occur, here's a pair here, K-minus and K-naught bar, and then at exactly the same energy as K-naught and K-plus. Incidentally, I forgot to say, every particle has its antiparticle, except. For instance, the pi minus and the pi plus are antiparticles, but the pi zero is its own antiparticle. The k minus and the k plus are antiparticles, and the k naught and k naught bar are antiparticles. In addition, in this chart, we have also got some, in the last 6 months, some more particles, or, you know, maybe particles, the same way as up here that disintegrate almost immediately. A thing called an omega, which goes into three pions, has a mass 780 on this scale. And then, somewhat less certain, is an object which disintegrates into two pi's. And then, if I wanted to continue this chart by putting double question marks, I could increase the number of dotted lines rather by three or four more. But I don't want to go to such double question marks yet. But we'll let you know at the end of the year whether there are some more dotted lines. All of these particles, these are called the mesons, and those are called the baryons. The mesons and their antiparticles are the same, But the antiparticles of the baryons must be put on a chart over here backwards. Everything written anti, 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 all the charges reversed and so on. Now, just like Mendeleev's chart was very good, except there were a number of rare earth elements which were hanging out loose from the chart, so we have a number of things hanging out loose from the chart. Particles which do not interact strongly in nuclei, that have nothing to do with a nuclear interaction, and do not have a strong interaction. I mean a very powerful, the kind of powerful interaction of nuclear energy. And those are, they have electrical interactions or other interactions, but those are called leptons. And they are of the following. There's the electron, which has the mass very small on this scale. See, 0.510 and so on. This is 938. That's almost 1,836 times heavier than an electron. That's the nucleus is so much heavier than the rest of the atom. Then there's this other thing, the mu minus meson, the muon or mu meson, which has a mass much higher, 200 and something times as heavy as an electron. As far as we can tell by all experiments so far, the difference between the electron and the mu meson is nothing but the mass. Everything works exactly the same for the mu as it does for the electron, except that one is heavier than the other. Why is there another one heavier? What's the use of it? In addition, there's a particle, a lepton, which is neutral and is called a neutrino and has zero mass. These masses are the masses of the particles at rest. Finally, we have two other particles which do not interact strongly with these nuclear things. One is the photon, and perhaps if gravity is also, if the field of gravity has also got a quantum mechanical analog, a quantum gravitation, which has not yet been worked out, then there will be a particle, a graviton, which will have also zero mass. What is this zero mass? These masses given here are the masses of the particles at rest. The fact that it has zero mass means, in a way, it can't be at rest. And a photon is never at rest, but is always moving at 186,000 miles a second. So we can't, the mass, we'll understand better what the mass at rest means when we understand the theory of relativity, which will come in due time. This, then, is the horrible condition of our physics today. To summarize it, I would say this. Outside the nucleus, we seem to know it all. Inside, quantum mechanics is okay. The principles of quantum mechanics have not been found to fail. So if we add, if we write down the stage of, on which we put, into which we put all of our knowledge, we would say it's space-time, the relativistic space-time. Perhaps gravity is involved in the space-time. We don't know the initial conditions, and we don't know how the thing got started, the whole universe got started, so we don't know that part. And we have never made experiments which check our ideas of space and time accurately below this tiny distance. So we only know that this idea works beyond that distance. We also add the rules of the game on the quantum mechanical principles. And those quantum mechanical principles apply, as far as we can tell, equally well to the new particles as they do to the old particles. But the origin of forces problem in nuclei leads us to new particles, but they appear, unfortunately, in great profusion without a complete understanding of their interrelations, although there are some very surprising relationships among them. I don't have time to explain the use of this chart in predicting various reactions, and perhaps we would come back to that a different time. Thank you.
Not very thorough. It was just a mention, actually. of something called a quasi-particle involving helium.
Involving what?
Involving helium, a quasi-particle, or something that is given off from helium when it...
No, that's, I know what you're talking about. That idea is the following. If you, in water, for example, you've seen a whirlpool. And if you start a little whirlpool, it'll move along. And the water is continuous, but the whirlpool has a pattern of motion in it that can make its way from one place to the other. Now, in liquid helium, for example, there can be an analog of a whirlpool or something like that, which propagates and moves around from place to place. It can hit against the walls, bounce against them, and so on. So it behaves in many respects, in fact, when you add the quantum mechanics, in a great accuracy, very much like a particle. It's not a real particle, it's not another atom, it's just a pattern of motion which is wandering around, and this is called a quasi-particle.
Well, what was interesting in this thing was it had a according to the article which I read, which was not a very reliable source, science fiction magazine, it appeared to have a certain mass.
Well, that's analogous to its inertia. You see, if it hits a wall and bounces off, it gives some
and
momentum.
It would, if there was a pool of liquid helium, and you suspended a vein above the pool, and it hit the vein, it would cause the vein.
That's right. You read about that. That's all right. Because it hits the vein and it knocks it back. You can do the same thing by making whirlpools with a spoon, vortexes, I mean, with a spoon in the water, and they'll move along. And if you put something in the way, it'll get pushed.
I was reading somewhere that they thought they found that protons and neutrons are composed of chymosomes and some other neutrons.
No, that hasn't been deduced. There's many possible pictures. It's possible, for instance, that a proton and an antineutron stuck together is a pi. If you look at it, you see the masses don't work out at all right. But the interaction energy can be so big. You see, in the case of relativity, when the energy is given off, the mass reduces. So it could be that they're bound. And there's 100 other possibilities of this being made into that. Nobody has got a picture of which ones are made out of which that works in any consistent way or that's any better than any other combination. So there's no model at the present time of any of these particles in terms of the other that's generally accepted. There are many ways you can play the game, but they don't, one is as good as another as far as we know so far. Yes, sir.
What constitutes an anti-neutron?
Well, what constitutes a neutron?
Well, I mean, how does an anti-neutron differ from a neutron?
Oh, that's easy. The antineutron and a neutron, when they come together, will annihilate each other. And a neutron and an antineutron and a proton, for example, can come together and annihilate and liberate pions. The antiparticle doesn't mean that the electrical charge is reversed, but many of the other properties are reversed. In fact, when every one of these things is called a baryon. And if we associate a number with them, like 1, 1, 1, 1, plus 1 for all baryons, 0 for all mesons, and minus 1 for all anti-baryons, then there's a rule. The number of baryons in a reaction never changes. In other words, a proton and a neutron cannot come together and disintegrate into mesons because I put two baryons together and I'm asking to get something of 0 baryon number. That's against the rules. That's one of the rules which I didn't have time to explain. But if I take a proton and an antineutron, which has baryon number minus 1, they can annihilate into mesons. So we have other numbers besides electrical charge, which guides us in understanding these particles. And those other numbers are opposite for a neutron than they are for a proton. I didn't finish the lecture, I see. I forgot one blackboard.
To what particles does the uncertainty principle apply?
All.
To all particles?
All. The quantum mechanical principles apply to the whole of the world, as far as we know. No exception.
How do they rate a rest mass?
That's the energy they have when they're at rest.
Well, according to the uncertainty principle, I would think that they don't rest.
If you have a very great uncertainty in position, then the momentum can be pretty surely zero. So you can get them restier and restier, provided you don't admit that you know where they are. Okay?
Can
yes.
You explain nuclear forces by an interaction similar to interatomic forces? I read recently that protons have several layers of different charges.
Oh, that's two different things you're asking at the same time. First, the interaction of atomic force is via the electrical interactions, and they are via photon exchange, or electromagnetic field exchange, which is represented by photon. Then the interaction between proton and neutrons, we believe, is represented by a field, and that field has a particle corresponding to it, the pion. So that part is yes. The answer to the first part of the question is yes. Now your question as to the proton having layers of plus and minus charge, it has been possible to measure the charge distribution, the density of electricity in a proton as a function of distance. And it's found to be a curve that goes something like this. Yes, something like that. While inside a neutron, it's a curve that goes something like this. So that the things have some kind of apparent structure, but we don't understand what that means yet.
Then the surface, according to that curve, then the surface of the neutron then has a negative charge?
The outer parts of the neutron have positive charge. This is plus here.
Oh, I thought that was a distance scale. Right?
No, this is distance, radial distance, and this is a charge density as observed by scattering electrons from these things.
So ordinary electrical forces are inadequate to explain nuclear force.
Yes, sir. I wished I had summarized here what we know. I forgot to list the couplings. The photon is coupled to all charged particles, and the strength is measured by some number here. Its law is completely known. That's quantum electrodynamics. Gravity is coupled to all energy. Its coupling is extremely weak, you see, so much weaker than electricity, like that, those tons that I was talking about. And its law is completely known. Then there are weak decays, like the neutron disintegrates into proton, electron, neutrino, relatively slowly, beta decay of nuclei. And its law is only partly known. It's rather slowly. But the strong interactions, the mesons and baryon interactions, has a strength 1 in this scale. And the law of it is completely unknown, although a number of rules are known, and I have these rules, like the number of baryons doesn't change and a few others. But these are not known, and these are necessary for nuclear physics. The electricity is not enough to understand the interactions between the nuclear particles at all. It's too weak. It makes very small differences in energy, but it's not the main part of the energy.
What are the other baryons?
How do they find them? Well, if you bombard, for instance, if you hit, you make a very energetic proton in a machine, and it goes very, very fast, and it hits a piece of matter which contains protons and neutrons, then you will find some things coming out. And the reaction might be, for instance, a proton plus a proton makes two protons again, but then some debris comes off. For example, well, let's change it. Makes a lambda and the K meson, for example. Let's get the charges right. This is possible. So if you find that if you bombard, say, hydrogen gas with protons with enough energy that these things come out, you can see these things in cloud chambers. I realize I put too much into this lecture. I should have made some slides of that and also explained this. Is that enough, or you want some more out of it? Well, if you know what a cloud chamber is, you do. Okay. If you take a hydrogen chamber, cloud chamber, or a bubble chamber, which is more effective, and you take the beam of protons, you see a track coming in like this, and then you'll see, in this particular case, a track going like that. That's this proton coming out. And then let's make the bubble chamber bigger. Then all of a sudden, you also see a V-shaped thing here, and another V-shaped thing, say, here. There's a picture will look like that. And the excuse me. I've got to get everything right here. There's another track coming off here, and then it has a kink. So, like that. And if you look very close, you'll also find more stuff, but something like this. Now, what's happened in here is that you can check what these particles are, what their masses are, by how far they go and how much they curve and so on. So you identify this as a proton. You identify that this has a mass of 494, say, you see? So that's that one. And what does it do? Well, it disintegrates. These particles are unstable. It disintegrates into a pion and something else. And here you see it, nothing from here to here, but suddenly this V-shaped thing. This V-shaped thing is this, that a lambda itself can disintegrate into a proton and a pi minus, for instance. And if you identify these pi, you find this is a proton, this is a pi minus. So that's one of the properties of the lambda. Now you can figure out from the momentum and energy of these things what the momentum and energy of this must be. And you find it had to be moving in this direction. If you figure out where, it comes right back to that point. And so you've identified that particle and so on. So all these particles are really chicken tracks in a cloud chamber.
On this indeterminacy deal, that is an inherent basic indeterminacy?
Yes, sir.
And not something that just isn't possible experimentally?
No, it's not possible experimentally, and therefore it's fundamental. Because the control of everything is that the sole test is always experiment. Now, if there's no experiment whatsoever that can detect the combination smaller than H, then whatever you say about it is nobody's business because there's no way to check it. But the thing that's interesting is that the quantum mechanical laws would be inconsistent if it were possible to measure better than this. No one has ever figured out a way to measure better than this, and it all fits together. If you were to come along with a scheme that beats this in measurement, then there would be necessarily something wrong with quantum mechanics, which there might be, but so far as we have yet, no one has ever thought of an experiment to violate this, and so the quantum mechanics can still exist. It does, and all the laws agree. So I suspect that it's really true and that you can't do it as a fundamental fact. Yes, sir. They're called antiparticles, and the relation of a particle to its antiparticle is always this. Its mass is the same. A lot of various numbers are changed, like, for instance, the charge is reversed, and other things can happen like that. In the case of electron and positron, it's just the charge, and another number called the lepton number, but never mind. Then finally, this is interesting, that the two, a particle and an antiparticle, can come together and then merely completely annihilate each other. They just disappear. Making energy comes out in the form, say, of photons or pi mesons, or whatever, depending on the problem. Yeah, in a way, if you want, there's a way of representing it. It's a rather a peculiar one, but it's interesting. If you plot space this way and time this way, then you could see something like this, that if a particle is standing still, then the place is always the same no matter what time. Looks like this. If a particle is drifting, then the place moves forward, like so. Now, we then imagine we can describe the motion of various particles by lines here, and this means that the particle is this way, you know, you go like that, that would be this. But we might ask ourselves the question, what would happen if a line could turn around, the same line? Like this, what would that represent? What would it well, if I just don't worry about this end of it for a minute, this would be a certain kind of a particle, but this is the same kind of a particle here running backwards. You see, at a given moment, we would have two particles. But this would be, in some respects, different than this, perhaps. Some respects, the same. And then the two of them would come together, and there would be nothing left of them. And we would say that we annihilate it. So one way of representing particles and antiparticles is this, that a particle can go backwards, so to speak, in a time, space-time diagram. And the backward section, relatively, is when it's looking like an antiparticle. And that's the relationship that works in all the cases. And of course, this can reverse this way. That's the opposite. You can create a positron and an electron with two gamma rays, say, or with energy. Well, everything is hypothesis, you see. The whole thing is, we don't care where the idea comes from, but we have to check its validity with experiment. So if the point is that this idea is a hypothesis, but it's checked very, very accurately, everything agrees. If you take the law, for example, which determines in the quantum mechanical equations, the chance that an electron going this way will be deviated and go this way by photons, say, by light, deviation law, and you just keep on substituting new numbers, more deviation, more deviation, more deviation, you get a formula for deflections by different angles. Now, if you're going ahead and you just take the same standard formula, but you let it deflect back, I mean, you make the angle in the space-time look like that, you'll get the correct rate, the correct formula for the probability of annihilation of an electron and a positron. In that sense, this theory is valid, in that sense. That whatever formula you have this way, if you just extend it to the case when the other end is backward, it still works.
You also could make with another electron coming this way, and then you have the first electron being formed from the bottom.
Here? Like this? Yeah, that's a formation. And the probability of a formation can also be calculated from the probability of a deflection. That's right. Either way. And the point is, though, that you get the right answer for everything. If you imagine it's a single electron deflected very hard by using the regular rule for what energy it takes to deflect it through certain angles. And then if you deflect it through that kind of an angle, it works just as well. It's funny, but it works.
And then the when the two representation of the same electron are together, come together, then the annihilation, it doesn't mean the annihilation, it just gives off change in energy.
It gives off photons.
There's nothing actually destroyed.
No energy change, no. Energy is never changed. You can't get rid of it. It's never destroyed, so you don't lose any energy. And there is energy even with a particle standing still called a mass energy. So when they're standing still and annihilate, there's still a certain energy equal to this much. Where's the electron in this chart? Twice this. Well, does that satisfy you all?
What about an idea that five qualities, not exactly particles, not waves, but something like five qualities? And
yeah, seven. Understand all the rules.
Yeah,
well, I say there are some rules that are known about these interactions, which are several things, that the number of baryons doesn't change, that the electric charge doesn't change. And then there's a very funny number which is given over here, the S. And that in any fast reaction or hard reaction, the S number doesn't change, any rapid or production reaction. And so there are a lot of rules like that. So if you want to, what it says is that you can make all the particles up and all their properties, if you never mind how to calculate it, but just imagine that the pi on is 2 proton and antiproton and so on. And you might ask yourself, how it's a minimum number of particles you have to start with in order to get them all. And I believe it's 7. Well, you got 5 because you hear 5 because they don't include the photon usually, which, or you could make it out of electron, anti-electron, but I doubt it. But maybe not. So it depends on, there's sometimes, it's hard to say. There are 5, perhaps 6 qualities. It's hard to say. The big problem is what to do with the muon. How do you make it? Is it another quality than that or not? We don't know.
Are you going to be around this afternoon?
Yeah.